So we're in Parshat Matot. This week, actually, we read Parshat Matot and Maaseh together. In Israel, they have been 1 week ahead of us since Pesach, which is very frustrating. And we're catching up this week. So this week, they read only Maaseh. We read Parshat Matot and Maaseh. The Jewish people by next week will be once again united. Very exciting. There is a major piece in Parshat Matot, a story, like a little bit of a storyline that we're going to tackle today in chapter 32. So it's on page 410 in our books, page 410 in our Tanakh. And it is the story of Reuben, Gad, and Chatzi Menashe, and the half of the tribe of Menashe. And we have a lot of questions that we're going to tackle as we go through this. In the story, a little background is, if you remember it all, 2 weeks ago in Parshat, the end of Parshat Balak, the women of Midian seduced the Jewish people to commit the crime of the Baal Peor. What this crime is, it seems to be, it doesn't say this explicitly, but it seems to be pretty clear that it was some sort of sexual act done in a public fashion in front of the gods of this Baal. And this was something that, there were 24,000, thank you. We're on page 411. There were 24,000 people who died in this plague and the aftermath, but it was quite devastating. It was actually much more. It was more of a blow to the nation. What some of the commentaries compare it to was the sin of the golden calf, part two, because here was in the middle of the Jewish people. Remember, this is 40 years later. They're about to enter the land of Israel. This is the generation that's going to enter the land of Israel. They're preparing to enter the land. It's only months away. And suddenly, out of nowhere, they commit this idolatrous act in a very public fashion. So it's really very, very similar to the sin of the golden calf. And in this respect, last week on Shabbat, I explained that the tribe of Shimon was really decimated, according to most explanations. Really, almost all 24,000 were from the tribe of Shimon who died, at least we can deduce that. It was an affront to God, and it almost decimated the Jewish people at this moment where they were about to enter the land. So it's really the same, a very similar story to the sin to the golden eagle, to the chet of the hegel, the sin of the golden calf. But this is take two. Now in the aftermath, if you remember the story, Pinchas then takes the initiative. He takes his spear and his zealots act, etc., etc. And last week's portion tells us that the Jewish people were given a mandate, soror et ha-Midianim, that you were supposed to harass the Midianites. And one has to understand that this wasn't just any battle. This was a battle in defense of God, right? That the people were told, listen, this is not just a battle for land, because this is not our land. This is the land. The land that we're after is the land of Israel. This is a battle because these people were offended God, and as the defense to God, you need to show them to defend themselves. In fact, last week I mentioned on Shabbat, I mentioned that there are commentaries to say this is shows that there's the Jewish people have a right to defend themselves, to attack, to go to say, don't mess with us. You mess with us, there'll be a response. So the Jewish people respond, they decimate this land, and then in the beginning of the portion, there is a division of the spoils of war, and that brings us to where we are in chapter 32, which is, well, then what do you do with this land? That makes it's a legitimate question, because remember that the Jewish people are going to inherit the land of Canaan, the land that's going to become the land of Israel, and this is in the Transjordan, so it's not the land of Canaan. So, but they did just conquer it. So what do you do with this land? Do you just leave it empty and don't worry about it? You took the spoils of war, now you just go off. Or
sell it.
sell it, right? What a good Jew would do if they find some real estate agent and hire a bunch of contractors, right? All right, or that's the Jews are the contractor, right? Hire a bunch of people and get whatever and sell it. So it's an asset to the nation. And the tribe of Reuven and Gad approach this and see this in a very different way. Now, there are, remember that this is more than the stories that we read here have to be more than just a history lesson. It has to be that there's a message here. And the question is what is the message in the retelling of this story? So let's start on page 411, chapter 32, verse 1. Okay? It tells us, now, the deal with the air conditioner is that as soon as it gets too warm, we're going to put it on. But it does affect the sound. So if we start getting too warm, then we'll they'll let me know. Or if everybody falls asleep, then I'll know that it's got too warm, okay? All right, so here we are, chapter 32, verse 1. It says, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had abundant livestock, very great, atzuma od. They saw the land of Jazar and the land of Gilad, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. Now, of course, what do you need if you have livestock? What do you need?
Grass.
You need grass, right? What did the cattle do all day? They just eat. They don't really do much, right? I remember you ever hang out with sheep, right? They make a big noise. They look up. They see there's nothing wrong. And then they go and eat more. There's really not much they do, and they need a lot of grass, right? So the children of God and the children of Reuben came and sent to Moses, to Eleazar the Kohen, and to the leaders of the assembly, saying, Atrot and Dibon and Jazir and Nimran, Cheshbon and Elea and Sibam and Dibon and Ibion, all these places, that land that Hashem smote before the assembly of Israel is the land for livestock, and your servants have a lot of livestock. They said, if we have found favor in your eyes, let us be given to your servants as a heritage. Do not bring us across the Jordan. Okay? So we don't want to go to Israel. We want to stay here. Because we have, look at this opportunity, and you're just going to waste it, and we request to stay here. Okay, that is their request. The truth is, it's a legitimate request, right? Because from a financial standpoint, we want to set up over here. We'll make a living, and we'll do very well over here. It's a fairly legitimate request. What's your problem? If you get this request and you're Moshe, what's the problem going to be?
Because you're destined to go to the land and they don't want to go.
So first thing you're going to say is, wait a second, we have a destiny. This is not the destiny. So first you're going to talk from a theological standpoint, right? From a theological standpoint, you're going to say, wait a second. This was not the deal. The deal is that we're going to enter the land that flows with milk and honey, and that's the land of Israel, the land of our forefathers, and this is not the land of our forefathers. That's number one. Number two.
It'll set a bad example for everybody else.
So as soon as people say, well, there are two things. When you say set a bad example, right, so the example hasn't been set yet, right? So in other words, there are two things. Number one is that the people are going to say, look around, there are 11 and a half tribes here. There are 12 tribes, 13 tribes. And the other tribes are going to come and say, wait a second, why don't they want to go? Right? What's the problem? Oh, it's very prosperous here. Why should we go over here? The other example that it was set is that it tells you as soon as there are financial challenges, what is everybody else going to do? They're also going to run. So from a practical standpoint, it sort of it sets a bad precedent for and also perhaps even intimidates people from the beginning. What else?
God.
What about God?
God is not going to be. God's going to take the people into Israel. Safely. And that's not happening if they stay there.
Well, it doesn't fulfill God's promise, is what you're saying. Right, so they're saying, listen, I know God made a promise, but we're happy here. And guess what? I mean, to respond to you, they do say that this is land that was conquered by God. So what's the difference? God conquered this land, he'll conquer the next land. It's all conquered, God's conquered land. So what? Right? We're acknowledging that this is God's conquered land. We use the language. The land that Hashem smote before the assembly of Israel. We didn't conquer this. It's all holy land. Holy Land is land that God conquered. Not necessarily, at least they're saying, the land of our forefathers, but it's still a holy land.
Well, this is the land that God conquered for their safety to get through to Israel.
No, because they could have just walked through. No, remember we said in the introduction, this was the land that God conquered as a revenge for what they did. They seduced us to serve other gods. Therefore, we're going to have. I'm going to show them that this is God, the revenge of God. That's what it was. It says of God, Pinchas avenged my. I need you to go to war to avenge my anger, because God was offended. Whatever that means, right? And so, that God conquered it. It's not. There wasn't protection. It's not about borders. God, someone's going to come into this land anyway. Eventually, somebody's going to show up. And during that time, there was always a displaced people, right? People would go from place to place. They would get thrown out of one piece of land. They'd go to another piece of land. So someone's going to end up there anyway. So what? So why can't we do it, right? And we're recognizing that it came from God. What else is the problem?
Well, also a whole generation died out before because they were not willing to go in, which was kind of a waste. And I guess it's almost the same thing again. They would not follow Joshua this time as opposed to...
So what's the issue?
The issue is that everything they've done since that time was heading for one particular purpose, and this kind of defeats the purpose.
We had a plan,
yeah,
right? And now it defeats the purpose. Why don't we all settle here? Why bother going into the land? That it sort of disrupts the plan. I hear...
Well, now but people died because they were not willing to keep the plan, and now they're willing to just give it up.
Well, so they're saying so. There should be a love and appreciation for the land of Israel, recognizing its role. People died for mm-hmm. this. This was something that we lived for. It almost as if Lahavdil, right, to separate, but maybe not so far, is that we take it to contemporary times and we rewind 100 years ago. So at 100 years ago, I think it was 1903 or 1904, Theodor Herzl was given a proposal and said, listen, I know you've been longing for the land to return to the land of Israel, to return to Palestine. I'm aware of this. It's too political. It's problematic. I'm not getting anywhere. They made me an offer. It's an offer I can't refuse. They said, we're going to go to Uganda. Go to East Africa. It's still a land for Jews. We'll settle the land. The land will be a safe haven for people. By the way, if you think there was, I don't know, we can't rewrite history, but if, let's say in 1939, when the war was started, when the Holocaust started, let's say there was a place for Jews to go, right? Let's say there was no place for Jews to go. Let's say there was. In the middle of Africa, there was a place, in the corner of Africa, there was a place for Jews to go. Is it feasible to believe that lives would have been saved? Significant amounts of lives would have been saved? It is feasible to believe. So, I mean, Herzl, who didn't really see the writing on the wall, right? He had a very different agenda, but there was a point. So Herzl says, let's take Uganda. And what was the response of the Zionist Congress? No, we're not interested, right? So it's a little bit of a parallel here where they're saying, listen, we'll take another land. What's the difference, right? We're here. Right, I know that this was the promised land, but this is fine too. This will do. And we'll settle over here. We'll live. We'll send our checks to UJA. They'll plant some trees for us, right, and everything like that. And I'm covering all the different organizations: JNF, UJA, B'nai B'rith. All these, they'll send their check, whatever. We'll be very supportive. We'll have an appeal every year, but we're going to stay here in the diaspora and live our very wealthy, comfortable lives because it's easier, right? Why should we bother? There are a lot of questions that are coming in, but one of them. We're going to see is, what Sharon said before, that people died for this because they didn't have an appreciation for the land of Israel. In the back of Moshe's mind, and you could see his response, that is very present. That says, wait a second, what's your real issue? Let's see Moshe's response. And Moshe clearly takes this not well at all. Verse 6. And you can see, if I could just say, at the end of verse 5, there is that last thing that they say, do not bring us across the Jordan, right? It's like almost, God forbid we should go, mm-hmm. right? There's a great line that we can be reminded of as we approach the 9 days in Tisha B'Av. Is a great joke, they say, that's a little tongue-in-cheek. This guy, a husband, comes home and says, honey, I heard from the rabbi that when Mashiach comes, we're going to leave our homes and we're going to leave our where we live and our ever, and we're all going to go to Israel, right? And his wife says, you know, honey, we've been through financial challenges, we were through hurricanes and other differences and all difficulties. We'll be able to deal with Mashiach too, right? Don't worry, we'll get by, right? We'll figure it out and we'll be able to keep our home, right? God forbid Mashiach will come and we're going to leave our beautiful homes in Long Island or wherever it is, right? So this issue of prosperity in a different land, which has come up many of times, and you can think of the parallels, right? I often bring the parallels of 1948 and Cyrus in the year 586 BC, year 526 BC, something like that, right? Is that Cyrus comes in with a proclamation. We studied this in the book of Ezra, right? Remember this. Cyrus comes in with a proclamation. It says, "You are now able to go and rebuild your temple. Go and return. This is under my sovereignty. You can go and return and build the land." And how many people went? Always come the number. We read in the book of Ezra, 42,300, right? How many people stayed? Probably hundreds of thousands, if not a million people, right? Why? Because we had a good life. It's not easy going over there. Here we are. We can make a living. We can do well. We live in Persia. We get our Persian carpets. Again, we'll send our Persian rugs. Sorry, we'll send our checks, and we're all for it. God bless you. The same thing happened. The parallel of this is 1948 when they established the land in 1948. Ben-Gurion, Begin especially, believed, you can see the Begin's words when in his museum. I've mentioned this before. You can see Begin's words. He's like, "Come, we'll make room, we'll figure whatever. The time has come, we're returning." And they didn't understand why the North American Jews didn't come. They didn't understand. They couldn't fathom that this is the thing that we've been living for. And it's not even that in 1948, living in America was like living in America today, by the way, right? The comforts were not, and we have some people who were around that time. The comforts, we were never as comfortable. The wealth that we have today is not even, can't even fathom, right? Our grandparents and parents would never have dreamed that we live in the wealth that we live in today in America and the opportunities. And still in 1948, they said, "Nah, we're just too comfortable here, right? We're just going to stay here. And we wish you luck." And they raised a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. The amount of money that was raised for Israel, for the settlement of the land of Israel, was unbelievable. I was just looking at the numbers. I have a quote somewhere. I'll try to bring it next time. It was unbelievable how much money was raised in a not incredibly affluent time. Right? I mean, there were people with money, but there was still not enough ever. But still, they weren't going. They weren't going. And so this is a story that has been retold and rewritten over generations for thousands of years.
So how comes today we are here?
Ask a very good question. So why are we still here? Yeah, so...
It's here in Israel, and it was 1948.
Right, so you were there in 47, 46, right?
48, I was here.
Right, right. But in the mid-40s, you were here. You knew what it was like in that time, when there was no food and no...
But it was a different reason, at that time. So we came because my husband was the only son.
Right.
And he couldn't offer anything for the elderly peasants over there.
Right.
Meanwhile, he is well settled. So it was a question, should he come or should they go to Israel? But I said he couldn't offer them anything in Israel. So we decided to come here for 2 years.
For 2 years. It's been a long 2 years. It's been a long 2 years. A lot of people are like that, you know, because it was hard. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, about the food rations. And it was hard. The life today is nothing compared to what the life was 70 years ago, right?
We still don't go.
And we still don't go. We still don't go. So if you want to ask my, I give you my personal answer, because we're hypocrites. If you want to know my personal answer.
It's also because you have familial attachments here. Yes. I remember the first time I went, I already had two small babies. And I said if I had come before I was married and settled, I think I would have stayed. But I had family,
right.
My parents, me, and my children.
There are ties. And it is, we can have this bigger discussion. Yeah. It is different. It is a different culture. Yes. It is a different
language. It's of our defense, really. The Israelis will tell you, too, that without American help, it wouldn't be Israel the way it is today.
Yeah. So you're right.
Because the Jews are here.
But things have changed. Things have changed in the last couple of decades. Where it used to be that and people will tell this to me, that we go, and don't get me wrong, Israel needs America, thank God, and needs the support from the diaspora, but it used to be that we were, the American Jews, or the Jews of North America, were supporting the land of Israel. It's very different today. Industry,
well, not financially, but politically, it's still important.
Financially,
yeah, no.
It's a whole different animal.
Yes, right.
People are living in very comfortable lives over there.
Right.
There's still poverty, there's still whatever, but they are a economic power, much different than they were even a couple of decades ago. I'm going to turn on the air conditioner,
okay.
And if it gets too loud, you let me know.
Okay. Isn't it more expensive to live there, too, isn't it?
My cousin sent pictures, her granddaughter just had a baby, and I see the apartment there.
It's a challenge. I don't want to focus too much on this, whatever. I don't get me wrong. If I could, I understand. I understand that if I move to Israel, so everybody and their grandmother is a rabbi, right? So and they don't have a model of a pulpit rabbi. I have all of these. I recognize all of this, right? And I recognize this is different. It's a different country, different culture, different. There are a lot of differences, and I don't think that people can just get up and leave. But if you asked me, if we're looking from a historical perspective, and you're looking around at what we see today and what's really happening. If we took a step back and said, "Wow, right? How can this be? And we're still here." And what I always tell people is, from an ideological standpoint, if you're a real Zionist, you always have to ask that question. Doesn't mean you're moving tomorrow, but you always have to say, "Wow, how can I still be here considering what's going on?" And again, we're reading the book, chapter 32. They did it then. They asked the same question. They're promised everything they're promised. They're saying the land's going to flow with milk and honey. Everything's going to be amazing. And what did they see? They see this incredible opportunity, and they stayed. And they stayed. They didn't go. Right? Now, let's look at Moshe's response, because Moshe's response almost seems like a simple misunderstanding, but I'd like to propose that it has to be much more. Because, let's look at Moshe's response. So Moshe said to the children of God and the children of Israel, right? And the translation doesn't do it justice. Shall your brothers go out to battle while you settle here? ! It should be an exclamation point there. There should be some curse words, right? This is Moshe saying, who the heck are you that you're going to stay here and sit pretty? We're about to go to war. You're going to sit here and say, oh, listen, you know what? I wish you the best of luck. We're going to stay here. You go fight your battles. And we're going to stay here. Moshe is livid. Why do you dissuade the heart of the children from crossing the land to the land that Hashem has given them? And this is what Sharon said. What are you doing? You're going to, not only is there a practical question, like how could you possibly stay here while everybody's fighting? They're going to think that you're retreating. They're going to think that you're scared and that's why you want to stay here. We have a war to fight. There's a war that's about to happen, and you're going to sit here back and say, oh, well, that's not my problem, right? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. They went up to the valley of Eshkol and saw the land that had dissuaded the heart of the children not to come to the land that had given them. The wrath of Hashem burnt on that day, and he swore, saying, if these men who come up to Egypt from the age of 20 years and above will see the ground that I saw swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for they have not followed me fully, except for the son of Kaleb, Yefunah, the Kenizzite, and Joshua, the son of Nun. They followed Hashem. That God was said, they'll never see the land. Those people who didn't love the land, who the rebels of the sin of the spies, they no one of that generation will enter the land because they didn't want to enter. They didn't want to enter, they're going to die here. The wrath of Hashem burned against Israel and made them wander in the wilderness for 40 years until the end of the entire generation that did evil in the eyes of Hashem. Behold, you have risen out of the place of your fathers, a society of sinful people, to add more to burning wrath of Hashem against Israel. For if you turn away from after him, he will again let it rest in the wilderness, and you will destroy the entire people. He's ticked, right? He is, you see Moshe's response, and he says, who the heck do you think you are? You think I was born yesterday? You think this is all just done in a, like, you know, oh, you looked, oh, there's a little bit of opportunity for money, whatever. Look at the bigger picture. What happened 40 years ago? They didn't want to enter the land. They led to a whole riot that nobody wanted to enter the land. We're not going to do this again. This is not going to be the sin of the spies part two. I'm going to put you in a place right now. I'm old and I'm tired. Right? That's basically saying, this is not my first rodeo. You are not going to lead us into this trap. Who do you think you are? You're not going to enter the land and try and stay here. Now, their response, that's Moshe's response. Moshe is coming with a tremendous amount of baggage, saying, on a national level, I have a problem with this. You are going to mess everything up just like it got messed up 40 years ago, and I'm not doing this again. And the question is, we'll see from their response, well, was that really their intention? Their intention was very practical, right? It's not that we don't love the land of Israel. It's not that we're not, and we're going to see even, they make an offer that, let's look at their response. They approached him and said, verse 16, pens for the flocks we shall build here for our livestock and cities for our small children. We shall arm ourselves swiftly in the vanguard of the children of Israel until we have brought them into their place, and our small children will dwell in their fortified cities before the inhabitants of the land. We shall not return to our homes until the children of Israel have inherited every man his inheritance, for we shall not inherit with them across the Jordan and beyond, for our inheritance has come us on the east bank of the Jordan. They said, no, Moshe, calm down, right? No, hold your horses. Well, no, we're going to go. The children will stay here. We'll set up our flock and our children, our women and children stay here. We're going to go to battle. And not only that, the leaders say, we're going to go on the front lines. And in fact, they do. If you look in the book of Joshua, that's exactly what they do. They fight on the front lines and say, we will conquer the land with our brothers, brethren. We will not leave them. You know, and so don't worry. This is not what you assumed, right? And Moshe responds. Verse 20, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before Hashem for the battle, and every armed man before you crosses the Jordan before Hashem until he drives out his enemy for him, and the land shall be conquered before Hashem, and then you shall return, then you shall be able and vindicated from Hashem and from Israel, and the land shall be a heritage for you before Hashem. But if you do not do so, behold, you will have sinned to Hashem now for your sin and will counter. Build yourself cities for your small children and pens for your flock, and what has become from your mouth shall you do. So it seems to be that they say, Moshe says, okay, as long as you fulfill this deal, then it's not a problem. Then it's okay, right? So, in other words, what was Moshe's real concern, and what was not Moshe's concern? Do you understand? We discussed a bunch of concerns that Moshe would have, or what the problem with their offer. Moshe has a concern. What was Moshe's? And now Moshe's concern is alleviated. What was Moshe's? From basis, we can ask the question, what was Moshe's real concern and what was not his concern? Remember, we brought up a number of concerns, right?
That they give up to go into the promised land.
So, number one is they're giving up the promised land, right? They're giving up the promised land. Have they said that we're not giving up the promised land?
No,
they haven't. They're still giving it up, right? So, that was not Moshe's concern. In other words, you want to live here? Fine, go right ahead. All right, what was Moshe's concern then?
The children of them.
They're not supporting the other tribes and their brothers.
So Moshe's concern was a national level and says, we're that the people are going to be, they're going to be disheartened that you're not going with them. You're not joining with the land, with the people to conquer the land. You're you're going to dissuade the people from this project, and you're going to start a whole rebellion, a revolution that they're not going to want into the land. And they said, so this gets resolved. They said, no. We believe God is going to help us conquer the land, and we will go right then with them at every moment. At every moment, we'll go with them. Don't worry. And Moshe says, okay, as long as you do this, then I'm not concerned that you're giving up the land.
But they're leaving the children.
They're leaving the women and children and their cattle. They are, right? And not only that, it takes 14 years to conquer the land. So they're not going to be around for almost a generation while they're conquering the land. And they're leaving their women and children over there. So these people will not have their families around during that time. But Moshe doesn't have a terrible concern about that. That's your problem. My problem as a leader is a national issue. I have to make sure that people are inspired enough and not dissuaded to enter the land. You say you're going to go, that's fine. Right? So as long as you go, it's fine. You want to do whatever you want, that's your problem. That's not my problem. So we see what Moshe's real issue is. My question is why is this just some form of miscommunication? Is it that they didn't explain themselves right and therefore Moshe didn't understand and then they have to explain themselves, right? Was this their intention from the very beginning that they were, we're always going to go conquer the land? Or did Moshe respond, say, scare them and they say, no, we meant we're going to conquer the land. Maybe that wasn't their original intention, but now it is. They said it's our original intention, but when Moshe starts yelling at them, maybe that was not their original intention. Or was there something more? It has to be, I have to believe that it was more than just a miscommunication. Moshe, you didn't understand what we said. We meant we were going to go, all right? The whole time we planned on going, we just didn't finish what you were saying. No, we're going to go, we're going to conquer the land, you don't have to worry about a thing, we're just going to settle over here, and as soon as that's done, we're going to go in from the front. Why is it that we have this miscommunication? Is it just a miscommunication, or is there something else that's happening here?
They want to stay there, and they'll also contribute.
Right. But why does Moshe get so upset? It almost seems as though Moshe got upset for no reason.
She wants everybody together.
They tested Moses to see what his reaction was before they...
So you're on the boat that says they never really planned on going, right? And only after Moshe's reaction did they respond and say, no, we're going to go.
It doesn't make sense. They wouldn't leave but you leave the children, that means you're coming back.
And of course they're coming back. It's a given they're going to come back. The question is will they go with the rest of the nation to fight the war to conquer the land also. And then afterwards they go back to their family to settle this very prosperous, lush land. They want the best of all worlds. They want the best of all worlds. What I want to know is that why does Moshe get so angry? Why does Moshe get so angry? I understand Moshe says, if Moshe assumed that they were trying to start a rebellion and now he said, I misunderstood you, right? Moshe doesn't say after they clarify, right? Again, they make a proposal. Moshe says, that's your proposal? I can't believe it, you bums, or whatever. They say, no, that's not what we meant. We meant we're going to go, but then we'll settle afterwards. And Moshe says, okay, if you do that, then it's a deal. Then it's a deal. Moshe doesn't say, excuse me, I misunderstood you, right? Moshe doesn't say, Salachli, I didn't understand your question, your proposal the first time. Now it all makes sense. It's very, very nice of you. Instead, he still seems somewhat angry and distrusting. And I find it hard to believe that it was just a misunderstanding. Somehow, some way, I think Moshe is saying, I don't like your question from the very beginning. And even though I'm acquiescing and I'm agreeing with you, I still don't like this.
I don't think it's normal, the idea that they leave the family.
So
it's couldn't be alive.
So the first question is that does Moshe not trust them, right? They're making this commitment, and if you look at the book of Joshua, it's brought up. It's brought up in the beginning. Joshua says, "You better come," and they're standing there with their swords and their spears, and he says, "And you better come." And they do this every few chapters. It's brought up, and there's B'nai Menashe. There's B'nai Gad, and there's B'nai Reuben. They're fighting, right? So they're ready. They're still they're still fighting, but it's still always a concern. And I think what you're making, the point you're making is that in the back of their head, they're saying, "Are you still here? Right? Are you still following? Because we don't know. You know, your family's over there. You could leave at any time. You have no skin in the game, right? Everybody else there have to settle their wife and their children, their families, their flock. They have to settle. They have no skin in the game anymore. They're done. At any point, they could run away. And so there's a concern whether or not they're actually going to fulfill their promise. But I think there's another concern. And I think that what we can see actually even from a small text message something that Moshe does afterwards that tells us that Moshe has another issue that goes way beyond this. I want to take a moment and look back for a second.
Or maybe like Begin, he can't believe that they wouldn't want to come.
So part of this is that I think Moshe, throughout, Moshe always has this issue. Like he doesn't understand. He couldn't understand the spies. What are you worried about? What's your problem? Right, right. We're going about to enter the land of Israel. We're about the land of flowing milk and honey. Why are you complaining about the travel? Why are you complaining about the food? We're going to see amazing miracles. It's going to be utopia, right? And Moshe, and then later he even book of Deuteronomy. He says, "I wanted to go the whole time. This is all I ever wanted, and because of you and your kvetching and your never that I couldn't go." Right. But Moshe's longing to live in the land of Israel, to be the land of his forefathers, that's something that he's always had. So he couldn't relate to the people in this way. That's a given. Yes, Arnie?
Well, maybe, I mean, why wouldn't Moses be unsure that they will come? Because how do you leave your kids and your wife alone when they could be conquered while you're in Israel?
Right. So there's always that danger. So my guess is that there was always a provision that, like, we have this image that the whole nation shows up and is fighting a war. That's not how it is, right? There always were that people would stay in one place. There would be a camp where the women and children and the infirm would stay, and there would be a guard that would be there, right, who would be protecting them, and then everybody else would fight in the war. And that's the same thing would happen over here as well. I would imagine there would be people who would be on a rotation who would be protecting that area, and then the rest of the people would be fighting on the other front.
Well, how far away was this land and Israel?
It is the Transjordan, so it is beyond the Jordan River, right? I don't have a map here.
Jordan is
right.
Many places.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a bus. What happened to the area?
On the east bank.
Meaning eventually.
Yes.
This is no, that's not it. Okay. What happens that they lived there until they were exiled, and they were exiled with the like everybody else. If you look to page 2044. If you're looking down 2044 and 2045, you could see the territories of the 12 tribes, right? So the territories of the 12 tribes. Look at 2045, map number 2. Thanks to the Tanakh that provided for us. You see the tribes, right? You have the Mediterranean Sea all the way on the left, right? You see the tribes over here, and then all the way to the right is... is Menashe, which we're going to talk about in just a moment, Gad and Reuven, who are on the right side. And you could see, if you look on map number 1, you see the Jordan River on the right, and they're on the other side of the Jordan River. The Jordan River that we see today is nothing compared to the Jordan River that was originally. The Jordan River today is like a little bit of a puddle. Right?
Very disappointing.
Very disappointing, yes. It's really, it's not nothing, right? But in the olden days, when Joshua crossed the Jordan River, we had to imagine this was a much bigger deal. It's dried up significantly. So you're on the other side of a river, right? On the other side of the river. That's where the phrase goes. On the other side of the river, that's already, you're in a different country. You're in a different province. It's not a huge amount of space, but because you're on the other side of the river, it's going to be a very different, especially in those days, it's going to be a very different, you're going to be in a different, really, for all intents and purposes, you're in a completely different region, right? Even though it's a stone throw away from, across the river, but there are no these steam-powered boats or whatever it is, or ships, right? This is, it's a much bigger deal to get across the Jordan River at that time. Okay.
Is Petra at all result of
I can't answer that. I've never been to Petra, and I don't have a map in my head, so I would have to look at it. Yeah, I know. So that could be. It could be. I mean, part of this already is Israel proper now, right? So a lot.
It's two hours from there.
Right. So I would just need a map, and I don't want to answer incorrectly. Okay. I want to go back into the text that we have on page 411, and I want to see, I want to show you one small nuance that changes the dynamics of everything, and I think this is where Moshe has his problem. Okay? So again, we're on page 411, chapter 32, verse 4. We have the, as we read before, we have the request of Reuben and God, and it says, verse 4, the land that Hashem smote before the assembly of Israel, it is a land of, land of livestock and your servants have livestock. Verse 5, they said, if we have found favor in your eyes, let this land be given to your servants. No, I messed that up. What is the issue that I want? I'm sorry, verse 16. When they clarified their request, what do they say? They say, they approached him and said, pens for the flock shall be built here for our livestock, and cities for our small children. We're going to build, but we are going to arm ourselves and then go out to the land. We want to settle because it's very prosperous, so we want to build pens for our livestock to graze, and cities for our children. Let's look back, turn a page, and let's look at what Moshe says. When Moshe acquiesces and agrees to their request, he makes one small change. Verse 24. He says, behold for yourselves, city for your small children, and pens for your flock. What's the difference?
Children are more important than your flocks.
He switches it around. Right? They come in with their request and say, we want cities for our pens for our flocks and cities for our children. And Moshe says, no, you want cities for your children and pens for your flock, right? So Moshe, I think, in that one small nuance, in that one small change, Moshe is describing what the real issue is. Moshe is describing...
They're staying for the grass for their livestock.
They're staying for the money, right? Now, I understand there are times where you need to be able to support your family, etc., etc. Well, let me just tell you something, Moshe says. You're staying for the money. You're staying here because it's more flush. Didn't I tell you, or haven't we been promised, that the land is going to be flowing with milk and honey, a land that's wide? Do you think that you're not going to have enough over there? Do you think that God will not provide for you over there? Right? What's the real issue? The real issue is, it's not that you're worried about your family and you need to support your family. You want the money. You're going after the money. And this was a value issue that Moshe says, this is what the real problem is. Yes, I'm upset and I'm worried that the people are going to be dissuaded and say they're not going to enter the land. But it's more than that. Because I want you to understand, and that here we have to look at the greater issue and the distinction between what the values that they're leaving and the values that they're coming. The values that they're leaving Egypt is a value that is something that has been a challenge since the beginning of time. And I want you to take your little magic ribbon, and I want you to turn to Parshat Lech Lecha, and I want which can be found. On page 27. In chapter 13, remember that chapter 12 is where we learn Lech Lecha, where Abraham, our forefather, our founding father, is going to the land of Canaan, and he settles in the land of Canaan. And what happens immediately afterwards? First thing that happens after a great thing, fantastic, it tells us, there was a famine in the land, and where does he go? He goes to Egypt. First of all, why do you go to Egypt? Why isn't there a famine in Egypt?
They have the
Nile River. The Nile River irrigates the land. There is no issues of famine there, right? Which means it's a land of wealth, right? It's a land where people are always eat and are always comfortable. When the people in the desert say, oh, we remember the leeks and the watermelon and whatever that we eat there, the truth is they probably ate it there. It was a land that was full of plenty, right? And so here we have Abraham leaves his land. He goes to the land of Egypt. However things play out, who does he go with, incidentally? He goes with Sarai, his wife, and his nephew Lot, right? And Lot comes back and it tells us that right away, verse 1, so Abraham, chapter 13, verse 1, Abraham went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that was his, and Lot with him to the south. Abram was very laden with livestock, silver and gold. He pursued out to Germany, and he went to all these different places. Verse 5, also Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks, cattle, and tents. And the land could not support them dwelling together, for their possessions were abundant, and they were unable to dwell together. There was quarreling between the herdsmen of Abraham's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites were the dwelling in the land. So Abraham said to Lot, let there not be strife between me and you, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are family, if not all the land before you. Separate from me, if you go left, I'll go right, if you go right, I'll go left. And here's our verse. So Lot raised his eyes and saw the entire plain of the Jordan that was well watered everywhere. Before Hashem destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the Garden of Hashem, like the land of Egypt. The land of Egypt was a land that was lush, it was prosperous, it was a land like the Garden of Eden, right? Now, was it the land like the Garden of Eden? Where is the Garden of Eden in philosophy supposed to be? Meaning, we have a description of the Garden of Eden, right? That's paradise. And all the rivers run through it, etc. The Torah, the Tigris and the Euphrates and all these run through it. But it was the idea that it was paradise in the Garden of Eden, which we were there for a very short day, a few hours, right? What did they eat? Whatever they wanted. Except for one tree, right?
They did it anyway.
They did it anyway. But it was a land they would never be hungry. And to worry about clothing, right? Which means the weather was wonderful, right? Not cold, not hot. It was like Goldilocks, right? Everything was perfect. That is Shangri-La. That is the Garden of Eden. And guess what was compared to the Garden of Eden? Egypt. But Egypt in a very different way. Because Egypt was a land that had values that were centered around money, prosperity, greed. Incidentally, where does Lot end up? He goes in this land. And where is that land? It's Sodom. Sodom, the land of greed, of decadence, the land that is with no values at all. A land that is compared to Egypt. Where do the Jews live? They live in Egypt for hundreds of years. Part of the process of leaving Egypt wasn't just leaving slavery. It was leaving the culture of Egypt. It was leaving the greed of Egypt, right? Where, you know, this godless world, or this many gods, this pagan world, I should say, where everything was about greed and money and everything was available to them at all times. This was a process. They left it. They went to the desert first to say, we got nothing and we don't need anything. We don't need the land of Egypt. And how hard it was for the people to get out of that, because they kept saying, let's go back to Egypt. Whenever you read this, I always read this. Why would they go back to Egypt? They were slaves. They were this, they were that. Even the slaves lived well. Even if they were beaten and abused, and they were throwing babies, their babies into the water, and there was genocide.
And they had food.
there was still food. We always ate. There was always whatever. And we failed to appreciate that constant fear that people have that there wouldn't be enough food. Right? We don't want to appreciate that. Right? We don't appreciate... I was talking to the other day, if the winter is long, you could run out of food, right? You could run out of wheat. If you had a bad crop, you might not survive the winter because you wouldn't have, right? So this was always a concern. We don't have this anymore. This was always a concern. It was never a concern in Egypt. So they said, I know what Egypt was horrible, and I know we were beaten and slaves, etc. Let's go back. At least we'll survive. At least we'll always have what to eat, right? This was something that the Jews constantly did. Part of the process was to get out of that mindset. It's not all about the money. It's not all about what's right in front of you. God's going to take care of you, and it's not going to be so simple, and it's going to have to worry about rain, and you're going to work the land, but you have to have faith in God that it's all going to be provided for you. And the people are, and here comes this new, this Reuven and Gad, and they say, we're going to stay here. And we don't have to worry about that. Because here we know we have it. It's right here. It's just like... It's better than good enough. It's like Egypt. This is what we remember. It was what our parents talked about. How there was always food available. And we'll have places for our flocks to feed. And our family will eat, etc. We don't have to worry about this. Right? And Moshe says... Your values are all fakakt, and this is antithetical to everything that we've been striving for. So let me tell you first, it's not about the cattle, it's about your family, right? And let me tell you one more thing. I'm going to assign you, I'll read from page wherever, just a couple minutes left, but on page 413, it tells us again, back to our chapter in verse 33, they said, we commit, we're going to go, we're going to go. And then verse 33 says, Moses gave to them, to the children of Gad and the children of Reuven, half, and to the half of the tribe of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, the king of Sichon the Amorite, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and the land with the cities and the boundaries, and the cities of the surrounding land. Moshe granted them what they asked for. But he threw something else in. He threw half the tribe of Manasseh. Threw them in. Why do you throw them in? They didn't come and request this. He says, no problem. You'll go. You'll have whatever. Fine. You can settle there. You, God, Reuven, God, also I'm sending half of the tribe of Manasseh. The commentaries try to understand where this came from. Why did half of the tribe of Manasseh come? And they try to explain that maybe there was a whole... I can come up with a bunch of explanations. I don't have time, right? The Netziv, from Talit Tzvi Yehuda Berlin... who lived about 150 years ago, less than that, he had an answer. He said, why does Moshe send them there? Because he said, I need to send them this tribe, which is a good and committed tribe. A tribe, incidentally, that we just read about the tribe from five, there were five daughters from the tribe of Manasseh, the daughters of Selefchad, who had a love for the land of Israel, right? We have, this tribe has generally been positive and good, etc. We need them to influence them, to keep them connected to the land, and also, even more importantly, to keep their values intact. I'm sending this group, in Hebrew we call it shlichut, right? I'm sending this group, these rabbis from Israel, who are going to teach them what the values of Israel is, versus the values of Egypt, which are on the other side. And they are in between. And so, perhaps, and this is what he proposes, I don't know if that's shot, but at least he proposes, he sends this extra half a tribe, A, because half their people are still here, are still in the land, and B, they're going to be the influence to help guide the values of these Jews in the diaspora. Yes.
Wasn't Yaakov in Israel?
With Yaakov, Abram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov lived in Israel.
Right.
Yes.
So
the land of our forefathers.
Wouldn't these people want to go back to where their father was?
You're asking a question, Arnie. Why didn't I go back to the land that our fathers were? Why don't I live in the land of Avraham Yitzchak? No, why don't you live in the land of Avraham Yitzchak?
These were physical grandparents.
These are my physical grandparents. I believe that also, right? Why didn't the Jews go back right away? Because this is where prosperity is. This was the land of prosperity, right? And it was sitting there right in their face. And they were tempted, right? They went for the money. Now, they didn't say, and Rabbi Soloveitchik has a whole write-up on this, that says that even if you're living in the diaspora, your hearts have to constantly be fighting for their brothers in the land of Israel. And that's what they said. Our families might be here, but our swords are here. We're going to be fighting here, we're going to have... And that is the dualism, for lack of a better term, that Jews in the diaspora have to have all the time. Right? Libi b'Mizrach, my heart is in the East, I live here, my money goes there, my support goes there. When there are Jews or some, when there's a war, I am worried every single day about that because they're my brothers and sisters. And that's how Rabbi Soloveitchik, who lived in the diaspora, that's his model. This model is where our model has to be. That's how he describes. He bases his model of living in the diaspora on this scene of what Moshe describes. You are always going to be worried and fighting in the land of Israel, even though you're living in the diaspora. But I also think, and we could talk about this, the battle of the Western world that Moshe is concerned about. It's more than you're just going to stay here. Listen, it's more than that. It's that you're staying here because you want what they have in Egypt. You don't want what they have here in the land of Israel. And that is the culture that we've been trying to get away from for 40 years and failing. And you still succumb to it. Because that is something that is constantly, constantly calling.
Follow the money.
Follow the money, the prosperity, the easier life. And that is a value that Moshe says, let me yell at you for a second and let me just tell you. I already see what's in your mind. Because why? Because you said to me, we'll build pens for our flock and cities for our children. And Moshe goes, no. You'll build cities for your children and then pens for your flock. That small little change shows where their values were and where Moshe's trying to place their values back.
Good.